Love to talk about nature, wildlife, and enjoying the outdoors on this show. And our Wednesday programs usually focus on some aspect of that. And today we're going to be talking about the activities of various species of plants, birds, other wildlife, and when they take place each year here in our state. And that's the study of phenology. And we have a couple of great guests with us today to talk about it. Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. And great to see you again, Stan. Thanks for coming by.
Good to be here, Larry.
And also John Exo with us as well. John's a natural resources educator and assistant director with the Regional Natural Resources Program at UW Extension. And John, great to have you with us.
I'm grateful to be here.
I really appreciate having you both here as we talk about phenology. And I have the most amazing phenology calendar in front of me. But before we get into that, let's talk more generally. I sort of described phenology. I'm not sure I did the greatest job, Stan. How would you define phenology?
Oh, I think you nailed it, Larry. Yeah, phenology is the study of the timing of seasonal events. And I guess, you know, people have been keeping track of seasonal events probably for millennia, but as an actual organized activity, it really dates back about 150 years.
Okay, so we've been doing it for 150 years.
We have. And, of course, some records go back hundreds of years. There are some Buddhist monasteries in Asia that have kept track of the blooming of cherry trees going back hundreds of years.
Oh, man. What is there is a connection between phenology and Aldo Leopold, is there not?
Well, there's a really strong connection, and it goes all the way back to Aldo Leopold's boyhood in Iowa. He started at age 8, keeping a daily journal. And since he was interested in nature, his daily journals were essentially accounts of the things that he saw during his time out in nature. So he started keeping phenological records at a very early age, and he kept those records in his daily journals literally until the day he died in 1948.
Wow. And we have those records, or you have those records at some point.
We do. Almost all of Aldo Leopold's journals are in the University of Wisconsin archives, and of course we're particularly interested in the journals that he and his family kept from 1935 to 1948. At the shack, Aldo Leopold's weekend getaway up in Sauk County.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful place to visit.
It is. It's become something of a pilgrimage for conservationists because of a Sand County Almanac. But for those people that have read a Sand County Almanac, whether they realized it or not, the first half of that book is basically a phenological record of what Aldo and his family were experiencing at the shack, month by month, describing some of the iconic events that happened.
And John, you have, John Exo, you've practiced phenology for a while now. How did you get started, or when did you get started?
Well, similar to Aldo Leopold, I started as a child, grew up here in Dane County, western Dane County, near Riley, Wisconsin, which has also a connection to Aldo Leopold. And have continued through my life now with my family, where we live on a piece of land between Baraboo and Portage.
So you've been doing it a long time.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's and still fun for you, and fun to. Well, I guess it must be kind of fun to check back and compare from one year to the next.
You know, Aldo Leopold had he had many amazing quotes, but one that relates to his phenological record keeping. He said, keeping records enhances the pleasure of the search and the chance of finding order and meaning in these events.
Oh, wow.
And I think he's just nailed it. It is fun just to keep track of what you've observed, but it's also, of course, of scientific value to go back and look at your observations and see whether you can detect some patterns.
Talking today with Stan Temple and John Exo from the University of Wisconsin. Stan is senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation as well, and great to have them along as we talk about the study of phenology. Have you done some phenology work yourself? What's the most interesting part of it for you? Do you pay attention to and take note of the cycles of nature? I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, I haven't given that yet, so let me do it right now. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1110. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post your questions or your comments there. If someone wants to get involved in phenology, how would you start? What kind of equipment or tools do you need, or are there groups that we can get in touch with?
Well, that's a good question. Back in Aldo Leopold's day, you needed a pair of binoculars, a notebook, and a pencil. Today, most people that are actively engaged in collecting phenological records are using their smartphone or their computer. There are now several citizen science programs that engage people who keep track of nature and ask them to upload their observations to these central databases. The National Phenological Network covers mostly plants, but the 300-pound gorilla is eBird.
Yes.
eBird is run by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and on almost any day, thousands of bird watchers across the country upload their observations of birds. Most people are not going to be aware that eBird actually had its origins right here in Wisconsin. When I joined the faculty back in 1976, I started a statewide program called the Wisconsin Checklist Project. And at the time, I, being an alum of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, I was on their board of directors and convinced them to undertake a nationwide project, which became eBird.
Oh, it's a wonderful, wonderful project. And it comes up for discussion a lot on the program. I'm telling you, it's really great. And we often encourage people to go to eBird when we have questions or when people call in with comments or sightings. It's a wonderful place to go. I tell you what, I want to mention before we go to the phone and take some calls, and Kim will get to you and Dave in just a minute here, but your phenology calendar will find a place in one of my offices. It'll be up in my office, and I'm really looking forward to having it every month and looking at it because it is really, really well done. With beautiful photography, for one thing. And Stan, you've done a great job of updating the calendar with all of the events that take place over each month of the year.
Well, we did have to update it because those dates are changing.
Yeah.
Things, as you said in your introduction, things in the spring are happening earlier than they did in the past, and in fall they're happening later. So with climate change upon us, phenologies are shifting.
And the calendar, just to talk a little bit more about it, the calendar is, the photography in it, John, is fantastic. And I was looking to see it. Was it one photographer? But no. Several photographers involved.
Yeah, Larry, the calendar really represents a merging of a lot of things, including organizations, people, and as Stan has mentioned, historical data and more current data about phenology. But the calendar really represents a beautiful product that's a result of a partnership of a number of organizations, some of whom have contributed those spectacular photographs that you're talking about, and others have contributing writing of the sidebars that highlight some of those wetland indicator species of wetland health on the sidebars of each month.
Yeah, it's really nice that you're highlighting and featuring wetlands this year. It's wonderful sidebars pieces on various flora and fauna or wildlife. And, you know, I was just kind of looking through and, oh, okay, this is about the time of the year, I think, Stan, you put in that we should be looking for otter slides along mink slides along creeks and rivers. And
well, it's true, when there's snow on the ground, of course now there'd be more mudslides in southern Wisconsin, but it'll soon be sledding for those animals.
How do people get a copy of this calendar, by the way?
Well, a couple of ways. The most simple way is if they have access to a computer. It's available at learningstore.uwex.edu. That's our UW Extension Distribution Center. And then there's an 800 number, which actually is 1-877-947 7827, and the calendars are available right now for $15 each.
Yeah, it was 1-877-947-7827, if I that right?
That's correct.
Or go to the Learning Store. That might be the easiest way to get a copy at the Learning Store at uwex.edu, if I'm not mistaken. We have Kim and Lady Smith. Kim, thanks for waiting. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi. Just a couple of things. A shout-out for the Beaver Creek Reserve. That's around the Fall Creek area. And I go by their calendar, too, and just a couple of examples. A couple of years ago, I was like, oh, those foxes are not cute. They're playing out there. And then I looked over at the calendar. Oh, mating season. You know? And that was kind of funny. And then just a couple days ago, I go, oh, I haven't seen the common red poles at all last year. And I'm like, oh, darn it. I haven't seen them again. And then the next day, with the cold weather and the snow, whoosh, I have a huge flock of them. Just eating away at the finch feed. So, and I write down things on my calendar, and I have a bird journal, and it's a blast. I love it.
Oh.
And, you know, having the calendar is really nice because it lets you anticipate what you should be keeping your eyes open
that's
for.
That's what I love. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very... Thank you so much, Kim. I really appreciate
your
comment. Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Yeah, that's the nice thing. You can look ahead and say, oh, okay, I should be watching for this or that. And as Kim says, you know, then it's, oh, there it is, a day or two after she noticed. Dave in Montfort, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I'm still seeing sandhill cranes, and I'm wondering if that's unusual or seems to me they've always migrated about this time.
Hmm. Well, sandhill cranes, Canada geese, robins, bluebirds, they are all changing their annual migration calendars in response to climate change. And indeed, many of the historical dates on which we expected birds to either leave Wisconsin or come back in the spring have shifted, often by weeks or months. And some of the late dates in the year actually are no longer even relevant. We no longer really say goodbye to robins and bluebirds mm-hmm. and Canada geese during the winter. And increasingly, we're almost to the point where sandhill cranes are in the same category. I know a couple of years ago, the sandhill cranes that nest in my marsh stayed around and were there for me to count on Christmas bird count.
Mm.
They left, and I thought, well, okay, they're off to Florida. They were back the next spring on Valentine's Day.
Wow.
So they were only gone 6 weeks. And
wow.
I'm sure they didn't go to Florida. They probably hung out in southern Indiana and came back as soon as the weather warmed up a bit.
So we really, I mean, this, if there was ever sort of proof of climate change, it's showing up in our phenology.
It absolutely is. The blooming of plants is advancing, the timing of migration for some, but not all birds. And that's an interesting point, that not every species is responding the same way.
Oh, well, and so some are going about their business normally and others...
Yeah, that's right. If you think among birds, as a good example, many of our migratory birds in Wisconsin only go a short distance. They really only go a few hundred miles south. And for those birds, they are coming back much earlier. But a lot of our birds go all the way down to the tropics. And if you're spending the winter in Costa Rica, what's happening in North America is pretty irrelevant to you. So they time their migration by day length, by photo period. And that, of course, remains constant from year to year. We haven't figured out a way to mess that up yet.
Okay. Stan Temple and John Exo, our guests today, as we talk with them about phenology and the wildlife phenology calendar. Looking forward to hearing your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call or email us at talk@wpr.org. Or, hey, post a photo or a question on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking phenology with our two guests from the University of Wisconsin. And Stan Temple, also with the senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Stan Temple and John Exel. John with the UW Extension as well. He's based in Baraboo. Great to have both of them with us today as we talk phenology here on the Ideas Network. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Derek in Green Bay next. Derek, hi. Thank you for calling.
Howdy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the school, but I'm a student up at Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin.
Sure.
So I'm all about keeping an eye out on what's going on in the forest and fields around me. And I've recently gotten into mushroom hunting. So I was wondering if anybody could tell me what I could keep an eye out for, maybe some other plants that might be blossoming at the time that it would be a good idea to go searching for morel mushrooms.
And Stan, I bet you've probably lectured at one point or another at Northland College.
Oh, I have, definitely, yeah. You know, it's a good question, and it raises an issue that often gets confused in people's mind, and it's the difference between climate and weather. And for the emergence of morel mushrooms in the spring, there is a climate component of that. But much more important is the immediate weather conditions, the immediate temperature and moisture that stimulates them to emerge. And that's true of a lot of species. You have to distinguish between climate, which are these mm-hmm. long-term, year-to-year trends, and weather, which, as we're painfully aware in Wisconsin, especially this week, can fluctuate dramatically from day to day and week to week. So with morels, you know, weather's a big component. But there certainly are other species that are going to be responding to climate and weather in ways similar to morel mushrooms. So there could indeed be some indicators that morels might be emerging in the woods. I must admit, I have not been a great believer in some of those stories about the oak leaves as big as squirrels' ears and things like that. But yeah, probably if you looked at it over the long run, there may be a correlation there.
A little correlation. John?
Yeah, well, that was just a point I was going to pick up on. And it's so interesting that Stan mentions the oak leaves the size of squirrels' ears, because one observation that many old-time farmers would make is that they would plant their corn when the oak leaves were mm-hmm. the size of squirrels' ears. And they've also noted the change in when that occurs. And so by implication, they're essentially noticing the changes in climate through the differences in the timing of when that occurs. And occasionally they make mention of that. So it's kind of a neat intersection of the issues of climate and weather together in that particular instance.
Are you a morel mushroom hunter?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, you're from that area of the state.
Unfortunately, I haven't had a lot on my particular property, but my neighbors have quite a few, and so we share information quite frequently about that.
That's wonderful. Stan, you...
And, of course, Larry, I mean, for you, especially if you're a gardener, you can't help but be aware that the growing season in Wisconsin is getting longer and longer by a couple of days a decade. So that also, of course, affects the cycle for planting and when things emerge.
I talked to somebody on the show last week who said, well, I still have three tomatoes from the garden yet. And I said, well, it was just a couple weeks ago that I ate the last of ours, the green ones that, you know, you wait and have ripened. But I tell you what, I don't think 10 years ago I would have even considered having tomatoes around at this time of the year from the garden. So... obviously, they were green tomatoes that we brought in, but still, they were much later in the season that we were able to do that. And Derek, thank you so much for calling. Ned in Wausau, we'll give you a chance. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I teach zoology in the UW system, and I just had a number of people in my class do an optional extra credit report on climate change effects on Wisconsin wildlife and fisheries. And the one thing that I found very interesting is I just got a technical bulletin from the DNR of Wisconsin entitled Climate Change Impacts on Wisconsin's Wildlife, a Preliminary Assessment. And this is technical bulletin number 197 from the DNR. And for those interested in impacts on Wisconsin's wildlife, I find it an outstanding little document. It's not huge, but it's got some really good information in it. But in addition to that, my students talked about such things as, for example, the decline of the snowshoe hare and how its coat is not blending in with the snow background at certain times of the year. It might, the pineal gland is the one responsible for changes in coat color. And apparently, the coat is not always blending in with the background environment. And this is because of changes in climate over a period of decades. So I find that very interesting because it's a major source of food for the Canada lynx and also for the American marten. And so both of those are found in Wisconsin, but not in big numbers. Mm-hmm. However, the snowshoe hare is in quite a major decline, is what I found out from reading many of these papers and their citations. So I just wondered if you wanted to talk about that, or perhaps one other thing, just real quickly, in the aquatic environment. John Magnuson from UW-Madison, who's now retired, from limnology there. He also has written some papers that document the decline in the brook trout, our native trout, and that is greatly in decline, and just a small increase in temperature of streams is going to cause a major decline in that population. If it goes up 7 degrees Fahrenheit, it'll be 100% of the streams in Wisconsin, is the prediction, will be without any brook trout.
Yeah. Amazing figures, Dan.
Well, yeah, thanks for those comments. We've been sort of focused on one of the ways that species respond to climate change, which is by adjusting the timing of their seasonal events. But, of course, the other way that they respond is not by shifting the timing of their seasonal events, but by simply shifting their geographic ranges. As the climate deteriorates for northern species, they tend to retreat from the southern portions of their range where temperature, snowfall patterns are changing and turning it into uninhabitable places. And certainly the snowshoe hare is a perfect example in Wisconsin where they are retreating northward, and almost all of the climate models that are predicting the future of climates in Wisconsin. And you can read a lot about that in the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts report, as well as the DNR bulletin, are predicting that there are going to be quite a few of the species that we now think of as being typical of northern Wisconsin that are simply going to move out of the state. They just simply won't be with us anymore. They'll shift to the north.
Mm. Well, I was just going to pick up on the points about water quality impacts and physical impacts to water in the instance of the brook trout. And I guess the point I'd make here is that the issue of phenology and the study of the timing of events really dovetails with a lot of other interests and issues. For example, there are people who are interested in much more narrow observations of physical environmental characteristics such as water quality, the temperature of water, different other characteristics of water quality. And so this is an instance where some of the people that are monitoring for water quality by monitoring temperature and other aspects can help confirm or deny some of these predictions. And the instance of phenology, it really isn't a prediction itself. It's really a collection of observations.
An observation,
sure.
Yeah.
And so some of these other fields of study and other ways that citizens can get involved in monitoring their environment really dovetail nicely to help try and understand and explain what some of those changes mm-hmm. are occurring and why they're occurring.
I heard that the Aldo Leopold Residence Hall has a phenology project, Stan.
That's right, Larry. Yeah, last year, of course, we dedicated a new residence hall on campus, giving it Alto Leopold's name. And for next spring, I've been interacting, as well as one of our graduate students in forest and wildlife ecology, interacting with the students there. And they've decided to undertake a spring project documenting the phenology along the Lakeshore Nature Preserve, which is essentially their backyard.
Right.
So the students are going to be spending the entire semester learning about Alto Leopold and phenology, and then going out and collecting their own data to add to the website.
Very, very cool. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in again. We'll go to Patty next, but there's a spot for you, too, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. 1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page for that. And Patty and Madison, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I have a bird question. This is the first year I've left my bird houses out in the backyard over the winter, and we've had some sparrows taking out the nesting material that was left over and putting new nests in. And this has been going on and off. I catch them in the backyard over the last, I would say 6 weeks. And I'm wondering if that's a typical behavior, and if it's if you can tell me a little more about that.
Well, it's a behavior that's not completely unexpected. The sparrows that you're seeing are almost certainly either house sparrows or house finches. And they are both exotic species in Wisconsin, in that they don't occur here naturally. They were introduced by people. The house sparrow from Europe, the house finch from the western U.S. But they are resident birds, and they both like to nest in cavities. And cavities being a very scarce resource in the environment, one of the ways to win the competition for that scarce resource is to get started early. And for these birds that are residents, when we have a warm spell in the winter, they get busy sort of preliminarily staking out their territories and looking for nesting sites. So that's almost certainly what these birds are up to. I suspect with the cold snap that we're experiencing this week, their vigor for doing this will decline a bit.
Okay, well, that answers that then. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Patty. I was thinking back, Patty, as you were talking about the sparrows that I was observing my neighbor. This is a previous house that where I lived. The neighbors, he had a vent for, I think, a dryer, clothes dryer, and they were a louvered vent situation. And the sparrows had literally learned how to flip those louvers up and nest in there. And I'm sure that whole pipe was filled with sparrow nests.
I imagine there are a few houses that burned to the ground because of block dryer events like that.
Oh, man. Alex in Waukesha, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I'm an amateur entomologist, and I was just wondering if maybe your guest could talk a little bit more about how they're affected immediately by climate change. I did a study, and there's actually a family known as the Darners, and they're migratory dragonflies. And I've noticed that they have been staying much, much later. I saw a Darner in late November, which is odd, very odd. Usually they're gone by October. And I also wanted to give a shout-out for, since there's probably a good crowd for this. The Peregrine Fund has the American Kestrel Project, which is a box building project, because American kestrels are secondary obligate nesters. They need hollows. So just check that out. So,
all right.
Well, indeed, most invertebrates are very sensitive to temperature. And as a result, you're seeing lots of changes in not only sort of seasonal events, but actually sort of disruptions in some cases of their life cycle. Like you, Alec, I saw green darners very late in the year. And again, for invertebrates, since they are so sensitive to temperature, they are one of those groups that are going to be responding not only to long-term climate changes, but also to immediate weather conditions. And certainly for green darner migrations, a lot of the timing or the occurrence of when we see migrations has to do with the weather conditions. Some years the weather is just right. They get a good tailwind, and we'll see a lot of them in Wisconsin. And other years, the weather patterns are a little different, and you tend not to see as many. But certainly you're correct. Invertebrates are a group that are very, very sensitive to both climate and weather. And somewhat unfortunately, in the historical records that we have of phenology, those old timers like Aldo Leopold didn't really do much with insects and invertebrates. So it's kind of a gap in our historical knowledge.
Yeah. And Larry, one of the things that we really hope to accomplish with the phenology calendar is to inspire people to hone their observation skills and make note of those kinds of changes that they're seeing. So it's neat to hear Alex talking about that. And of course, one of the species we highlight in the calendar, or a number of species we highlight in the calendar this year, are wetland indicator species, indicators of changes in wetland health. And so, it's a great way to show some of those changes and highlight a wide variety of species that are indicators of health in wetlands.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, dragonflies are pretty interesting because they spend a large portion of their life cycle in the water, and they actually absorb a lot of what's going on around them in the water. So they're great index species as far as water quality and water health. So
yeah, good point.
And they are used that way. The late UW professor Bill Hilsenhoff developed probably one of the more widely used indices of stream water quality. Using aquatic invertebrates as an indicator.
Excellent. Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
And you go back and mention again the American Kestrel Society. Is that the...
It's the Peregrine Fund, which is out in Boise, Idaho, and they actually have an offshoot project for the American Kestrel. And they're box-building events all over the place, but you can also go on their website, which I don't have offhand, but if you just search for it, they have plans for a very easy box to make. And I've been at some of these projects, and people that are not handy whatsoever are able to make these boxes and hang them, and then you can report back your data as far as if they're inhabited or not. So it's a great project, and it goes right along with bluebirds are also a secondary obligate nester, so there's also projects like that out there. So
yeah, that project is very close to my heart because I was a graduate student with Tom Cade when the Peregrine Fund got started at Cornell. But there's a Wisconsin connection as well. Our own local naturalist Fran Hammerstrom did one of the early experiments showing that you could greatly increase the population of kestrels in an area by putting up nest boxes and removing that limitation that they experience of not having a good place to nest.
And they're really cool little birds, too. Yeah. They're very neat to observe. I actually have a box in my backyard, and I was lucky enough to have it inhabited, and they're fantastic to watch. So.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Alex, thank you so much. Appreciate your call very much. And you can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234. I'd love to hear from you as we talk about phenology here in Wisconsin with our two guests, John Exo and Stan Temple. The putting together of this calendar, I want to go back to that again and sort of highlight this wildlife phenology calendar. I mentioned a couple times the photographs, and how were you able to organize or get all of these photographs? Because it's from a broad range of
Yes, Larry. Well, each partner in this calendar, which includes of course the Aldo Leopold Foundation, the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, UW Extension, and through the Environmental Resources Center here, brings a talent and something of really significant value, and the Wisconsin Wetlands Association as well as the Aldo Leopold Foundation, have connections with some pretty phenomenal photographers.
Yeah,
we are really grateful for the photographers who've donated their images. And because they really are spectacular, and they're part of that inspiration that I talked about it, and just, you know, the leaf hopper image in the month of July of 2015,
unbelievable.
Just gives you a perspective of an insect like that that you never would imagine otherwise.
Yeah, and I happened to open it up to the November photo, and that eastern screech owl photo is unbelievable. It is just a most beautiful photograph of the eastern screech owl, the best one I've ever seen.
Trying his best to play invisible there.
Right.
Well, it is really wonderful. And again, I want to go back as to how people can get these calendars and so forth.
Yes, they can go online to learningstore.uwex.edu. And just type in either phonology or calendar, and you'll get access to it that way. Or they can call 1-877-947-7827, and that's also the Learning Store. And the calendars they make great Christmas gifts, Larry. I haven't had anybody complain about them in the past, and we've been producing them for 10 years or more. And they're $15 right now.
Yeah, and it's really a beautiful calendar. But I also, again, I like the sidebar stories on the various flora and fauna and wildlife. And as you were mentioning earlier, the fun thing is, I think, for this calendar is to look and see, okay, what's coming up here. You know, January, so looking ahead here, just January 5th, black bear sows are birthing cubs and dens. Well, that's not something we're probably going to witness ourselves, but it's kind of cool to know it. But then black-capped chickadees begin their spring courtship songs on January 7th we have.
Yeah, and when we updated the dates this year, these dates now reflect the earliest date on which you might expect to see this activity. And for chickadees, you know, we don't think of January as being particularly conducive to reproduction, but the days are getting longer. And it is that lengthening of the day length that stimulates chickadees to get interested in nesting.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, fascinating, and I really... as I said, that phonology calendar is going to be up and right over one of my desks, and I'm really pleased to have a chance to be able to talk with both of you about phonology in general, but especially about this phonology calendar. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry, so much.
Appreciate it very much. Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and currently Senior Fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, John Exel, Natural Resources Educator and the Assistant Director with the Regional Natural Resources Program with UW Extension in Baraboo. It's great talking with them. And, you know, one of the whole business about climate change, one of the things that we're seeing, I think, in a way, well, I may be confusing weather and climate here a little bit, but there hasn't been a lot of snow on the ground, which may have caused Darren Bush to be, I don't know, unhappy. He's always looking on the bright side of things. But the guy makes unbelievable snowshoes, and he's going to talk with us about snowshoeing here in the state and probably some other winter things as well, probably cross-country skiing and a whole lot more. You stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.